Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the major stories making the news in business and in politics here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up today in our Techscape slot, the platform that became the underworld's favourite app because apparently even criminals need customer service. And take a listen to this.
And I'm thinking of the Taoiseach's recent kite flying about a new department for infrastructure. And respectfully, Minister, it seems to many of us that your department, the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, should in fact be delivering on infrastructure, because that's what your department is for.
We'll be breaking down the Taoiseach's bold new idea, a Department of Infrastructure, because what's a government without yet another government department? We'll be looking at the arguments for and against. And finally, the honeymoon is over for Keir Starmer as the Labour Party conference gets swallowed up by black holes and the age-old Who Paid for That Shirt saga. Mark Paul of the Irish Times was there and he'll be here to tell us all about what happened this week. That's coming up on Taking Stock today, and you can email us at takingstock@newstalk.com or you'll find us on Twitter at StockNT. And now, as you may be aware, Taoiseach Simon Harris has publicly spoken of his plans to introduce a new government department, namely a Department of Infrastructure, should he be re-elected to government. But do we actually need another department? Well, one person who thinks not is economist John Fitzgerald, and he's on the line now. I'm also joined by Conal Thomas of the Business Post, who's also been writing about this of late. Gentlemen, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi.
Now, Conal, Simon Harris outlined his plans for this big new shiny department in an article in your paper. So I'm going to start with you, if you could take us through what the Taoiseach is actually proposing and what his rationale for a new department actually is.
Sure, yeah. So this was something that the Taoiseach had floated, I believe it would have been during the summer at the McGill Summer School. So just to set the background, I suppose, we've been hearing a lot about the infrastructure constraints in the country in recent years, and it's, you know, by all accounts going to get worse unless we address it. What he is effectively proposing is to set up a department to effectively deal with the blockages in major projects across the country, whether it's water, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's housing, whether it's energy and the grid. So they've basically, his party Fine Gael have effectively proposed this new department, and it's going to form part of their election, the election pledge within their manifesto. And I suppose the point he's making is that, you know, as he sees it, you know, roads, for instance, are done by the Department of Transport, houses are done by the Department of Housing, hospitals by the Department of Health. And while he's not saying it's a criticism of the current individual departments and what they're doing, he just believes that there is a need now to coordinate the delivery of infrastructure, given the constraints and challenges we're facing into the years ahead. And I'm sure we can talk a little bit about whether that's going to be a good idea, but that's the broad outline anyway of what he's proposing.
Right, well, thank you for taking us through that. Now, John, you're again this. It all sounds perfectly logical and reasonable when Simon Harris stood up at the McGill Summer School and then in the Sunday Business Post adding a bit of flesh to it. He got a lot of publicity, a lot of support, but you don't like it. Why?
I think it's pretty mad. I've seen over 50 years governments change responsibilities between departments. And the first thing is it takes 4 years to settle down. So things don't work for 4 years. The Department of Economic Planning and Development in 1977 was a disaster. I was chairman of the Climate Change Advisory Council from 2016 and up to 2020. And the department responsibility for the environment was shifted from the Custom House to Adelaide Road. And the problem was they left half the brain behind in the Custom House. And it's taken them 5 years to develop the expertise. So I think that changing responsibility across departments won't work. And the other thing is, the problem is the planning system labour. And dealing with the planning system, which would be in a separate department, that's where the single biggest obstacle to delivering on infrastructure is. And I think they need to target that first.
Mm. So, Conal, we're looking at a very, very complex system already. And John's point there is really that to start unpicking those massive projects and sliding them into one department is going to take so long to get his arms around that, that it's actually going to be counterproductive, just at a time, if I'm hearing right, when we need those things to work. And as you said, they're under strain, critical things like water infrastructure, energy infrastructure. What has the reaction politically been to this suggestion?
Well, I suppose it's interesting. This was being put out there by Simon Harris for quite a while, particularly late summer when it was quiet. And it was only, I think it was last week, I believe, at the Fianna Fáil think, and I was there. We were speaking to the Taoiseach of Micheál Martin, and he was asked, does he support it? And he was quite unequivocal. He says that he was not in favour of it. And his argument would be not necessarily in line with what John's saying around the challenges of setting up a new department. He was saying that, in fact, what we really need to do is overhaul and reform the public spending code. And what he did, he pointed to the National Children's Hospital. Obviously, we've seen a lot about that this week. As he was seen to be implying that the public spending, that the fiasco of the National Children's Hospital has actually made the state less brave to go forward with big projects. Now, just coming back, I suppose, to what John is saying there, I mean, that's the political reaction to it. I suppose one thing I might just add, like, there is a political element to all of this, of course. So, I mean, let's say hypothetically Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil go into government again. Now, Simon Harris has made this an election pledge, so he obviously intends to go forward with it. This could be a potentially huge and massively important government department. So there's a political aspect to who's going to get that. Bear in mind that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have switched over the finance and the Department of Public Expenditure briefs the last few years, two of the most powerful government departments. So that's the political side of it. I suppose just from our perspective, we did a recent poll on this with Red Sea, where we polled just over 1,000 voters to get their reaction to this. And the findings are quite interesting. So in the first instance, there's a majority of people are in favour of it. It's just over a third of people. But at the same time, while there's only 14% against the proposal, there's a lot of people, almost the same amount of people who are in favour of it, are either neutral or just effectively unsure about it. In many ways, because they probably don't know exactly what Simon Harris is proposing here. So it'll be interesting to see how this is going to be fleshed out by Fine Gael over coming months. One thing I would also add is that Simon Harris and the Taoiseach Department did recently set up a new group, which is being led by officials from six government departments, which is set to focus on investment in the national grid, water infrastructure and public transport in relation to, and particularly examining Ireland's competitiveness as an investment location in relation to those infrastructure constraints. So to me, my own view would be this is clearly a litmus test by setting up this group to see how it would work, to kind of fine tune it ahead of the general election.
Yeah, and could be a precursor to the civil service architecture, if you like, that you might need for a department like this to set up. I suppose, John, the thing that you and I have in common that a lot of people won't have is that we've worked closely with government departments and see how intricate the systems are within them. But I don't know if you heard Ivana Bacik during the week talking in the Dáil. She was questioning Pascal O'Donoghue on leaders' questions. He was standing in for the Taoiseach while he was away at the UN. And she made a very valid point, which is, you know, the Department of Public Expenditure had an addition to its title in recent years, which was the National Development Plan. And ergo, they are actually in charge of infrastructure.
Well, individual departments have got to deliver. Just take the metro. The metro should have happened 25 years ago. This government came in with a commitment they were going to deliver on it, and it has gone back into the planning system once again. So deal with the planning problem. So the metro, the problem is that they can't even get to the starting gate because and you have similar problems with other major infrastructure. The planning system is the obstacle. And what they've done is they've introduced an 800-page new planning bill. Now, anything that has 800 pages, it still hasn't got through the Dáil because it's so long. And there are going to be flaws in it, and it's going to end up in the courts, which will delay things another 3 or 4 years. So deal with the problems that are there before you start rearranging responsibility across departments.
Conal made a very good point there, John. I just want to stick with you for a second, if I can, about politicians being afraid to take on big projects because, like the Children's Hospital, they get mired in difficulties, the contracts become an issue, they're slower, they're more expensive. What would you do as an economist kind of looking on to this to kind of make the processes that are already underway, like the National Children's Hospital, like the Metro Project, how could you, if you went in, would you advise government to try and speed those processes up, to take those blocks away? And like, you can understand what Conal is saying there about fear of politicians when you see when they are held accountable for projects and they go badly wrong, it's not very politically advantageous for them.
Now, take, for example, hospitals. We need to build a substantial number of new hospitals over the and centralised services over the coming decade. And people say, oh, the Children's Hospital, take responsibility for that somewhere else. It was a very complex project, and I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of it. But the people involved in managing that have developed a certain expertise. Now, their name is Mud, so we get rid of them and bring in new people. Actually, having learned how to do a hospital, maybe the next one, they'll do it much more efficiently and see how they line up the contracts. Similarly, on the Metro, I hope they go to the Dart Underground before they finish the Metro and use the same expertise. The first time you do something, there's a learning process. If you take, for example, Beaumont Hospital, which was, I think, built in the 80s, I think they took the plans from the hospital that had been built in Cork and implemented it rather than starting from scratch. So it is use the expertise that's there and build on it. And yes, the Children's Hospital has been a disaster, but maybe the people running it have learned something that we should use in the future.
Conal, I'll bring you back in here. Like, we speak repeatedly about this new Department of Infrastructure being a place where the big projects go and sit. And there's going to be a lot of upheaval and mismanagement and complexity involved in something like that. And you could see why people like John would just think that that's going to be counterproductive. I was talking to Richard O'Donoghue, the TD, earlier in the week about this. He's in favour of an infrastructure department, and I asked him why, and he has a very different take on what a Department of Infrastructure could do. And it's more about planning around regions and bringing utilities like water and ESB together. Is that more in line with what the Taoiseach is thinking, or is his proposal to bring those big projects and centralise them?
I think there's a couple of ways you can look at it, because again, I would just say I think this will be fleshed out. So I'll just make a few points. Just on the first point that Richard O'Donoghue is saying, that is a very valid point. However, I think the counter argument to that would be, so let's just take a central Department of Infrastructure, which would oversee major government projects across government departments. Right? So that's one proposal. What Richard O'Donoghue is talking about there, I think, would be a greater empowerment of local authorities to lead on projects in tandem with probably better coordination with the government. There's often been, you know, and perhaps rightly so, the accusation for many years that since 1999 that the government has, you know, taken powers away from local authorities and in fact should give them back. So that's one thing. Just on the Taoiseach's proposal, I spoke to Pascal Donoghue about this, I think it was late August, and there's one, just to come back to John's point around, I suppose, reforming the planning system, and that is a very valid point, instead of, say, just setting up a new government department. Pascal Donoghue, though, did raise the issue, and he made it very clear. He said, while I will work with the Taoiseach on this, and it will be in our manifesto, what he said is, we need to figure out which major projects would fall under the aegis of this department. And I think that is something that will have to be very closely watched when that manifesto is published. And he made the point, John's made the point, obviously, about Metrolink, that's a good example, has gone back into the planning system for years and years and years. Pascal Donoghue, kind of on the other side, the slightly more, I suppose, positive side of it, said, do I take that project or do we take that major project out of the Department of Infrastructure when there have been officials who you can argue whether they've done a good job or not, who have been over that project for many years? Do we take that project away from them and into a new department? So my own view of this, and I wouldn't be surprised if ultimately if there was a new Department of Infrastructure, I don't know if it would be able, given we already have the departments in place, to take the major projects away from them. I think it is more likely to see, you'd have a new Department of Infrastructure that would almost be like an oversight body to coordinate these big projects.
John, I'll leave the final word on this to you, because clearly the officials in all the existing departments, probably the Attorney General, would be advising against this, and all of those existing projects that Conal has mentioned there might have to stay within their departments anyway. So you might be just talking about new creations and managing that. What do you think the motivation, Simon Harris as Taoiseach would have all this advice, what do you think is driving him to continue this?
Well, frustration with how long things take. Obviously, we're all frustrated, and I think go after where the constraints are. And remember, civil servants are there to plan at a high level. They're not engineers, they're not architects, they're not project managers. So the department shouldn't be doing that. You set up a separate body, as with the Children's Hospital, as with the National Transport Authority. Those are the people who project manage and have engineers. Civil servants move from department to department, and they're meant to be jacks or jills of all trade. They're not, and actually there should be much more specialisation in some departments. But project management is a specialist area which really doesn't belong in the civil service, and in many cases, as in the NTA, National Transport Authority, is not.
Well, look, forgive the horrible pun, but there's a very long road to go on this one, gentlemen. We'll have to leave it there. That was Conal Thomas of the Business Post, and my thanks also to economist John Fitzgerald. Thank you very much, gentlemen. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, Telegram, it's the platform with almost a billion users, but what's behind it? We'll hear all about it after this short break. And now it's time for this.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
You may have heard of the encrypted messaging app named Telegram in the past month, ever since Pavel Durov, the platform's founder, was captured by French police. But that what is less known about the app, perhaps, is the sheer volume of its elements and how many people actually use it, particularly in the criminal underworld. Drug dealers, white supremacists, and even more insidious elements across the globe are using this in great, great numbers. Well, here to tell us more about the app and its origins is Chris Stokel-Walker, who's tech journalist, author, lecturer, and programme favourite. Chris, thank you very much for coming back to Taking Stock.
No worries. Thanks for having me, Mandy.
Now, look, this has been in the news of late a lot, but I really wanted to start today with talking about who Pavel Durov is and how this whole platform started off.
Yeah, so Durov is an interesting character. Essentially, was one of the co-founders of a platform called VKontakte, now called VK, which was Russian's equivalent of Facebook. So he set it up with his brother years and years ago, basically at a time when Facebook was not in Russia because of various different reasons, including the fact that they kind of have a sort of quasi-parallel internet going on there where they prefer their homegrown alternatives. So VK becomes hugely popular, is the place that many people transact their business, interact with each other online, chat with each other and do all sorts of stuff, including fomenting revolution against the Kremlin, which is where Pavel Durov starts to get into trouble, Mandy, because around kind of anti-government protests against Vladimir Putin, a lot of those are being organized through VK, and the Russian government decides that this is not good. They ask Durov to hand over data of users who are basically planning their protests through VK. Durov refuses, and he becomes this, I suppose, cause célèbre for a sort of freedom and freedom of speech, freedom of information, and standing up against dictatorships. So he becomes hugely popular. Now, I'm conscious, Mandy, we haven't yet got into Telegram. So around this time, Durov and his brother decide that actually what they have with VK isn't quite strong enough, isn't quite good enough, doesn't quite suit what they want because it is still sort of semi-public. So instead they set up this messaging service similar to WhatsApp, I suppose, is what many of us might think of it as, where you can interact with people one-on-one or in group chats. And again, it has that same basic principle of we will not hand over your data. Around this time also, Durov leaves Russia because things get a little bit too hot for him. So that's how we get to the point of Telegram, I suppose, launching, and also how we get to the point of Telegram becoming this kind of having this reputation, I suppose, yeah, being a place where you can say what you want.
And so we want to look at the unique selling points of Telegram itself, looking at its unique features like the channels and the supergroups, because that's, I suppose, the thing that begins to set us apart. So when we're talking about numbers now, okay, in today's terms, what are we talking about in terms of how many people are using it and how many people are actually employed by this company when you're talking about the numbers that we begin to talk about?
Yeah, in terms of employees, we don't really know fully. This is one of the things. We understand, however, that it is much, much smaller than pretty much any other comparable tech platform that you can think of. You know, even if we compare it to, for instance, X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, you know, even after Elon Musk decided to take over that platform and basically fire most of his staff, Telegram has, you know, you can probably count them on not maybe one hand, not maybe two hands, but maybe if we got a room full of people and counted them on individual hands, you know, you're not talking about many here, probably certainly I would think less than 100. In terms of the user numbers, that is much more significant. And this is where Telegram is really interesting, because they're running a huge platform on what is essentially a shoestring budget when it comes to personnel. They have nearly a billion users. They got around about 950 million or so users at the midpoint of this year. And that is, you know, a really significant one. Many of them are concentrated in the Eastern European bloc, kind of Russia and elsewhere. But it does have a reach globally, and I think that is what makes it quite such an interesting case to examine.
Yeah, and who's using it? Like, what types of people? I mentioned in the intro there's lots of criminals and white supremacists and stuff. Who is using it, and why does this particular platform appeal to that kind of underworld, if you like?
Yeah, all of them and more, I think, is the thing. Yeah, there are several groups of people who exist on Telegram and sort of coexist and rub along against each other, either because they don't really interact with one another or just because they see it as really useful. So you have, in the most eye-catching way, the kind of criminals, both cyber criminals and offline criminals, who really like the idea that Telegram has had this very hardline view up until very, very recently of, if a government asks us for your data, we will do everything we can to not give them it, basically. Mm. And through that, and through lots of the other bits of functionality, including supergroups and multimedia messages that you talked about, and the encryption that you can turn on as well, it basically means that it's a useful haven for people to organize criminal enterprises. So you have that as one group. Then you have, I suppose, the kind of freedom of speech and anti-authoritarian sort of anti-surveillance campaigners who use Telegram because of much the same reason that the criminals do, which is Durov and Telegram have said they would not hand over user data if they were asked by a government. And increasingly, governments are asking for this stuff to try and tamp down revolutions before they begin. But that's not the whole story, to be honest. I yesterday was talking to a source of mine who is a really high-ranking world expert on protecting people from intimate partner violence and the way that that is done through technology. So essentially abusive partners either stalking, harassing, abusing their partners through the use of social media. And she was about to step on a plane to go back to New York. She happens also to be a friend of one of the friends of my partner.
That was an interesting segue. I was going to pick you up.
They're also popular on Telegram, potentially, Mandy. No. A friend of my partner's, she was about to step onto a plane. I know her relatively well. I was really keen to talk to her for a story that I was writing. And she and others in her social group use Telegram as their kind of main way of communication. And I think that's just because they're kind of from a techie, slightly nerdy background. This was the app that sort of group of people chose in the mid-2010s, and they've kind of stuck with it since then.
Mm. Yeah, and as you say, there's a great variety of people, different people using it at any one particular time. quite interesting to see those figures, though. A very small staff considering the amount of people that are actually using the platform. But let's move on to Djourov and the arrest. Why and on what grounds was he arrested?
So he was arrested because essentially, and it's really important to clarify here, this is not him personally doing this stuff, but instead his platform enabling this stuff. The French authorities, because Djourov is in part a French citizen, as well as we believe being a Russian citizen and a couple of other nationalities, he was alleged to have essentially allowed Telegram to become a haven for the distribution of images of child abuse. So French authorities were really worried about what we believe is a kind of child abuse image sharing ring that was using Telegram. Our understanding is that they had asked Telegram to take action before, and because Telegram has this very strident anti-government, no engagement approach to things, he essentially ignored it. And so things like the French government just had enough and said, actually, you know what, we are going to haul you off a plane when you land near Paris. We're going to slap you with an arrest warrant, and we're going to put you in part of this investigation as we try and uncover more and more. So that's kind of the reason, I suppose, why this all came to a head around about a month ago. This was back in late August when all of this unfolded, and it really caused huge ramifications, I suppose, around the world.
Mm. And is this part of the EU new laws kicking in, and could his case and what's happened to him set a precedent for other big tech holders? Because as you say, it's not his personal activity, but he's now being held responsible by law for what's happening and ongoing on a platform that he created.
Yeah, so those two big tech laws that you kind of hinted at, Mandy, there, they are the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act. One protects consumers from bad practice by companies using kind of their monopolistic tendencies. The other puts requirements on companies to behave properly when it comes to acts of law and things like that. Those two have become very important and very pertinent and frankly good weapons for regulators in Europe to use against these companies, particularly in the last year or so. When Djourov's charges were read against him, there was not a mention of either of those in there. Now, that's not to say that they're not connected. I think that what is interesting, and you kind of touched on it there, is that the DSA and the DMA, the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act, they do put a responsibility not just on the platforms, which can be slapped with relatively huge fines of 6%, 10%, depending on which one you look at necessarily, of their whole global revenue, but also actually there is an element in there of executives starting to be held responsible for the actions on their platforms. So it's that latter bit that I think French authorities were maybe looking at here when they decided to step in against Djourov, and the idea that actually tech executives have been able to kind of claim 6 degrees of separation and a little bit of distance that from what their platform does, and actually not so much anymore.
Now, we've both been looking at a recent New York Times investigation into this, which particularly looked at the messages that were back and forth, in particular in relation to criminal activity and white supremacists. You had a look at this for us. Yeah. Well, what's your analysis of what they found out?
Yeah, it's incredible, really. There is this concept of actually, thinking that this is a relatively mainstream platform, which it is. But as soon as you dig under a little bit of the surface, you start to see a really strong criminal underbelly. And that has real significant risks. So everything from kind of gun trading to terrorism to kind of white collar crime, as well as blue collar crime, the ability to purchase drugs and so on and so forth. The New York Times looked at kind of 1,500 channels that were operated by white supremacists. They looked at a couple of dozen channels that sold weapons. They looked at another couple of dozen channels that were essentially kind of drug marketplaces where you can tap in, log on and say, I want this. And it's delivered to your door from around about 20 countries around the world.
Chris, over the course of the last couple of years, you and I have been talking about various different ways in which communications are infiltrating into criminal activity and even war. What did you make of the recent situation in Beirut where Israel attacked the targets through the mobile phone network, or it was a paging network, but that idea that now governments are using communications tools which are in our hands as a tool of war?
Yeah, it is a really shocking, really kind of terrifying concept, I suppose. I mean, there are kind of two aspects to this. Number one is the communications thing, which we have always known that our communications are potentially being tapped. And that is one of the reasons why those terrorists turned to pagers, is because actually they thought that they were being tapped on their phones by the Israeli Defense Services. And they decided they would go for a slightly more analog alternative, and turns out to have really come back to bite them in many ways, with this kind of simultaneously terrible but also simultaneously kind of awe-inspiring attack in the way that they managed to get into the supply chain. I think that is the thing that also is worth highlighting, Mandy. And it doesn't come necessarily to this kind of telegram and communications and you know, eavesdropping element, but it does come in some ways to the risk that actually, you know, our worlds are increasingly interconnected. So I know we've had, you know, in recent days, the United States saying that they are going to try and outlaw China from getting involved in any kind of smart vehicles in the United States, because essentially what this attack with pagers showed is that if you are able to weasel your way into some sort of technology, you can essentially light a kill switch that can, you know, in some cases literally blow up in people's faces, but also in other ways could be used to, you know, immobilize a communications network or a network of vehicles. So, you know, that I think is giving people a lot of pause. This idea of, you know, our supply chains are very complicated. They can have things inserted into them. Sometimes that'll be physical bombs. Sometimes that'll be the digital equivalent.
Well, look, it's just bringing to the fore the importance of data, communications and defence. And sometimes we tend to think of these things as the things of science fiction movies, but unfortunately, they're becoming more and more real. But Chris Stokel-Walker, as ever, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your insights into all of this. That was Chris Stokel-Walker, tech journalist, author and lecturer. This is News Talk's Taking Stock. After the break, Keir Starmer, a £22 billion black hole, cast a dark shadow over proceedings at the Labour Party conference this week in Liverpool. We'll be hearing what went down after the break with Mark Paul of the Irish Times. Now, for our final item today, we're going to turn to the UK, because things haven't quite gone to plan for Labour leader Keir Starmer. Just 12 weeks after inflicting one of the biggest ever defeats upon the Tory party, Starmer is now grappling himself with internal division, accusations of sleaze and plummeting approval ratings. Well, this week, the Labour Party conference was attended by our own Mark Paul, who is a London correspondent for the Irish Times, and he joins me on the line now. Mark, you're very welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock.
Thanks, Mandy. Good to talk to you as always.
Now, despite a little rocky train ride which took you there in the first place, we might get to at the end, you made your way to the conference. Just before we get into what happened there, maybe give us a sense of the problems that have presented themselves to Keir Starmer since he came into office, because this is his first big party conference as Prime Minister.
Yeah, and you would have expected a conference like this, I suppose, to be a victory parade. And I think a lot of Labour members wanted it to be a big celebration of their massive election victory, but it hasn't quite worked out like that. Like in Liverpool, it was dark and cloudy, and that reflected the mood at the conference in a way, because in the run-up to it, some of the problems that have presented themselves to Keir Starmer are roughly, they fall into two kind of categories. One is the freebies, and the other one is the infighting in number 10. With regards to freebies, there's a particular donor to the Labour Party called Waheed Ali. He's a Labour member of the House of Lords, and he seems to have been funding all sorts of stuff for different members of the cabinet. I mean, for example, he donated 18 grand to Keir Starmer to pay for suits and shirts and so on, and designer eyeglasses. It seems he paid for the 40th birthday party of Bridget Phillipson, who's the Education Secretary. He his apartment in Manhattan was used by the Deputy Prime Minister before she was Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, for a holiday over New Year's. He has an £18 million flat in Covent Garden that Keir Starmer's son used to study in for his GCSEs, for somewhere quiet to study for his GCSEs to get away from the press. So there was this perception, I suppose, has built up of sleaze around the Starmer government. And whether or not you think that accusation is fair or not, it's still something that Starmer has had to deal with. And one of the reasons why it became so politically toxic was because, you know, parallel to all of this, the Starmer government has tried to has kind of brought in means testing for winter fuel payments for pensioners. And I suppose people are saying, well, hang on a second, you're taking fuel payments away from some pensioners, and yet you guys are on all sorts of freebies.
It's just not a good look, is it, in politics when you're explaining your clobber? We have it here with the Charvet shirts and everything. It's exactly. Absolutely the opposite of everything Keir Starmer kind of said he stood for when he came in. So, yeah, it's not good. The other thing that you mentioned there was the internal struggles he's having. Yes. Those internal struggles, are they over those policies that you talked about there, changes in the pension, or are there other things?
Well, there's a power struggle at the heart of Downing Street, and it involves Sue Gray, who is his chief of staff, and then other people, other senior advisors across the government. I mean, it's been known for a long time that there is a rivalry, I suppose, of sorts between Sue Gray and Morgan McSweeney, who is the Cork-born, I suppose, political brain of Starmer's Labour operation. And I mean, the latest iteration of that row was that it emerged that Sue Gray is actually getting paid more than the Prime Minister himself. So I think there, and that matters because Sue Gray signed off on a new system of pay for other advisors, which saw a lot of them get pay cuts. So again, it's just this sense of infighting in number 10, and which normally happens when a government is deep into its term and exhausted, but it seems to be happening at the start here, and that has caused another problem for Starmer. So he walked into this conference, which should have been a celebration, with a lot of dark clouds over the party.
Well, I can tell you, there's nothing better for politicians when the back room are the people in the headlines and not them, and if they're fighting and that's what's getting the attention, it distracts somewhat from them. But I take what you mean, like it hasn't got off to the lovely start that he would have wanted. Can I ask you this, Mark, about him in general? Because I watched the speech, and I've been watching things very closely since they came in with Angela Rayner, and the first thing they did was they said, oh God, things are much worse than we thought they are. There's a £22 billion hole here and we don't know how to fill it or fix it, but we're going to come up with a plan. When Tony Blair came in with the Labour Party, their kind of messaging was, you know, we are the change. Change is happening. With this crowd, you sense we are the change. It's coming. But they haven't actually put any meat on the bones of what it is they want to do, aside from some of these small things like the pensions. And they're not small things to people, but they're small things in a macro sense. But those even have kind of gone against the grain.
Yes, but I think the big difference between in 1997 and now is that Tony Blair, even though they came in on a mantra of change, he still came into a country that had an absolutely banging economy. It was growing very, very quickly. And he came in on a big wave of optimism. Keir Starmer has come in I think the British electorate gave them this huge mandate and this huge majority almost begrudgingly, and because there was never any real love for Starmer's Labour amongst the electorate. You could detect it before the election. And that meant that the honeymoon period has turned out to be very, very short and almost non-existent. They've come in and they've said, look, you know, everything is terrible and we have this £22 billion black hole that we're going to have to fill. They've gotten in trouble with some of their own members over that. And this is another thing that has contributed to the atmosphere of the conference. Is that there were accusations thrown at Starmer and also at Rachel Reeves, his very, very powerful Chancellor of the Exchequer, that they were almost talking Britain down too much. But Starmer, when he talked to people who know him and people around him, and I've spoken to some people who know him very, very well, they say, look, he just doesn't go in for this performative, happy-clappy kind of stuff. He's not very good at it. He sees Britain with a lot of problems, and he's trying to steal people for the fact that he's going to have to make, and his government is going to have to make a lot of unpopular and painful decisions over time. And I suppose, look, one of the risks of taking that approach is that, you know, you could become unpopular very, very quickly. And he doesn't have that kind of, you know, megawatt smile that Tony Blair had. He doesn't have that kind of, he doesn't come in bouncing, walking on air and optimism like Blair did. He's just not that kind of person. He's a sturdy, somewhat stodgy kind of a guy who makes very, very slow and deliberative decisions. But he gets there. I would compare what he's facing now to the situation that he faced when he actually became Labour leader, because he didn't make a very good start as Labour leader either. Well, he wasn't long Labour leader when they lost this huge by-election in Hartlepool, which was somewhere where the Tories should never have won. But under Boris Johnson, they beat Labour in Hartlepool. And he almost resigned after that because his message just wasn't getting through. But eventually he got there. I spoke to somebody who would consider himself a good friend of Keir Starmer, and he says he calls him the ratchet. If you can think of a ratchet as a kind of a tool, a mechanical tool, it only ever moves one direction. Slowly, slowly, it ratchets up and up and up and up and up. Nothing fancy. And that's kind of like what Starmer is like a little bit. He will get there eventually, his team say. You know, he moves along slowly and deliberately, makes these kind of unsexy decisions. But eventually, he seems to achieve stuff at the end of it all.
Yeah, and steady as you go is probably the absolute antidote that the UK needed after the whole hoopla of Boris and all of the fiasco of the Tory party and the mess that they made. So there's a period of time where he will get a bit of grace even for that. But I think that perhaps his communications plan around, you know, really opening up and saying this is how bad things are, repeatedly in his speech saying this is not going to be easy, this is going to be tough. It's like a 10-year communications plan for a government who wants to do the job well but needs time. The problem is he's running that communication plan in a modern media cycle, which, I don't know, could bore of it very quickly.
Yes, yes, it could indeed. I mean, look, you can only feed people a diet of gruel for so long before they look for something. But again, I think Starmer has almost tried to make a virtue out of the fact that he's not prepared to just throw people kind of empty calories. And look, you know, maybe he'll be proven right in time. Maybe his approach, his kind of slow and steady approach, will work. I mean, he has had some successes, I think, since he's come in as prime minister. There was a couple of things that people have found impressive. But I was particularly impressed by one section of his speech, his conference speech, when he spoke about the riots in Britain over the summer, which he is seen to have handled overall reasonably well. He spoke with real force, I'd say, Mandy, and real emotion about what he perceived as the vile racism of a lot of the campaigners. And I have to say, as a kind of an outsider in the British political ecosystem, media ecosystem over there, political media system, it was refreshing to see a British Prime Minister say that. It's been years since a British Prime Minister has spoken to that section of British society with that sort of honesty. And I think the actual handling of the riots themselves, Starmer handled quite well, because he was chief prosecutor, he was the director of public prosecutions the last time there was riots in 2011, so he actually had hands-on experience about how to do this stuff. He hasn't been bad on the world stage either. He has set out, he's been pretty successful in resetting relations with Ireland, for example, very, very quickly. That has warmed up. Now, that's obviously on the Irish side as well. It suits them both to do it. But he's been very vigorous in his courting of Germany, for example. He's been over there a lot. He seems to have struck up a bit of an unlikely friendship with Giorgia Meloni, the leader of Italy. They're kind of a chuckle couple, in a sense, whenever they meet up. He's managed to, before the election, he was criticised for being too pro Israeli, in a sense, by the Palestinian Workers' Party. But he has actually been quite tough with Israel since he's gotten in. For example, they suspended some arms sales to Israel, not all, and they have been very forceful in some of their statements on Israel. So he would consider that sort of stuff successes. But I think the winter fuel payments thing is somewhere where a little bit of political nous would have been required. I mean, if you're going to hit somebody with people with something like that, there should have been something to sugarcoat it, and there wasn't. And at the start, what I thought they were trying to do was to pick a fight over that, to show everybody that we're going to be fiscally tough. But I think it may have just blown up in their faces a little bit, because when that's now linked to the freebies row, I think all of that has come together to bring a real dark cloud, I think, over this Labour government.
Yeah, actually. And when you put it all together like that, Mark, in fairness, this conference is a small part of explaining to his own party what the road ahead is and what they should and can expect from him. So, yeah, that's right. When you put it in that context, he has done quite a bit, actually. And I think those riots and how he dealt with them, even here in Ireland, he's getting a lot of kudos for the swiftness with which he dealt with it. And we're kind of looking to see, well, why wouldn't the guard they hear kind of act similarly, you know, in a similar vein, and that would be a deterrent. I want to go back to that piece you mentioned in the speech about racism, because I did want to ask you what you felt the standout moment of the speech was. How was that? Well, how did that go down in the UK? Because it's a very honourable message. It's a message of the UK of old. But did that resonate with the people there from Labour, and will it resonate outside the room with the people of the UK?
I think it did. It very much resonated inside the room. Now, I mean, you have to take into account that he's in a very friendly room there at the conference. I mean, I was in the hall for the speech. It got a very, very huge reception. I thought he doesn't get emotional, Starmer, but I thought you could tell that it mattered to him, that you know, to focus on this aspect of real British values, that in Britain, and from his perspective, in Britain, you don't settle your differences by trying to, by taking to the streets and throwing bricks at people. He drew a real distinction between what he saw as the right of people to have reasonable objections to immigration as it impacts their community. But he drew a distinction between those people and the people who were out riding on the streets. He said people who had reasonable concerns over immigration were not the people who were out there trying to burn refugees, as he put it. I think there was a particular incident at a hotel in Rotherham that rioters tried to set on fire, and I think that really particularly got to Starmer. He has mentioned it a lot, and so I think it did resonate in the room, and you know, he got a huge ovation for it. It was one of the two biggest and moments for him in the speech. The other big moment for him in the speech was about the final 90 seconds to 2 minutes of the speech. He delivered very, very loudly and clearly throughout an ovation. The crowd were clapping and cheering for him at one moment, and they kept clapping and cheering. And instead of stopping to allow him to settle and continue with his speech, he pushed on harder and harder. And it became like this, like he finished on this kind of tidal wave of optimism almost, in a sense, about how we will achieve this, we will achieve that, we will, you know, we will build more houses, we will do more schools. Now, in a lot of sense, it was rhetorical. There wasn't really a lot of detail on how they would get there. But it was quite rousing. I thought that part of it was quite stirring. I think a lot of the criticisms of Starmer's speech or praise of it has fallen down, in a sense, on ideological lines in Britain. The sort of papers who we'd assume would go at him, like the Telegraph, they said it was a terrible speech. But as an outsider looking in, I thought it was a decent speech delivered quite well in difficult circumstances. And if the overall message of the speech was, listen, I never said this was going to be easy, steady yourselves, this, we've got a hard, hard road ahead, I think that message probably landed. And one speech on its own like that, I don't think is going to settle the Labour troops. But I don't think it's done them any harm.
No, and I think at the end of the speech, as you say, that vision idea that he put forward in the room was very well received, and something I suppose our politicians here might remember in the coming weeks as we face into an election, probably, our own. Mark, I did want to talk to you about that awful word that I thought I'd never hear again in my life, crew, but unfortunately time has run out. If you do get a chance, check out Mark Paul's article about his journey to the party conference on the Irish Times. That was Mark Paul, London correspondent with the Irish Times. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcast from. My thanks as always to today's guests for their time and their very, very valuable insights. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy. Simon Keane was on research and Hugo Silva-Scott was on sound. Sean Defoe is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.